was that everything that exists has substance. Even ideas have substance. Everything has substance. God exists, so God has substance. Now, just, you could ask yourself, I mean, the question, have you ever heard people ask the question, does God have a body? Well, in that day, the answer would have had to be, yes, he had a body. The idea of, I'm going to talk a little about Augustine's idea, view of evil. The idea of evil and good in that day was that if something existed, it had to have substance. It had to be something. All right? So, the question, what is evil? Well, evil is something. It has a body, a substance to it. It is something. It cannot be nothing. It has to have substance. Well, there's a dilemma in this. For Augustine, he didn't want to make God the author of something evil. So he said, evil is the absence of good. It's just the absence of good. That way, he didn't have to say that it's something that was created. Now, this does have implications for children. It has implications for you. What is evil? He said that evil is not a thing. It's not a substance, but rather it is the absence of good. God permits evil. He did not create evil. Okay? Now the next question is then, how did this evil get to... How did people become evil? And how does this evil come to Adam's descendants? What makes your children evil? And there were a number of answers about how children become evil. On the one hand, in relation to the origin of evil, Augustine said that sin is not a thing. Okay? But in the answer to the question of how evil comes to children, he said that it's propagated and it is a thing. It's passed from parent to child through the process of birth, at birth. You get a thing when you're born, and it's called, in their term, a sin nature. Okay? Now, the Anabaptist view, I will give you that now, just to keep this all together. The Anabaptist said that sin is an act. Sin is an act. It's not a thing, it's an act. Now, there's a dilemma in giving that answer. Because you can always ask, why do children then act that way? What makes them act this way? But the Anabaptist said that sin is basically an act that is the result of a choice. They did not say that children are sinless. They did not say that children have nothing in them that make them want to do bad until they get the term 10, 12 years old to the age of accountability, and all of a sudden they do something bad and that produces the thing in them that made them do bad. Do you follow what I'm saying? Anabaptists never said that. But they never emphasized, they never talked about a lot or try to explain theologically what it is that makes children at some point want to do bad, want to do the sin, the thing that's bad, the act that's bad. I'm sorry. I'll stay off. Quit not confuse my terms there. So for an Anabaptist, sin is an act or an attitude. It is not a thing or substance that you're born with that is another philosophical term. That's an essence in you. Okay? So they accepted the traditional view that children are born with something that makes them want to do wrong, but they never explained it. They rejected the idea that the child is guilty of Adam's sin, which is a Catholic view. They always said a person is born with original sin, meaning guilt of Adam's original sin. Okay? Now, if you believe that a child is born with the guilt of Adam's original sin, then you've got to decide, is this child going to go to hell? Is the child guilty before God and going to go to hell if it dies at 1 year old? Okay, a Catholic answer to that is yes. So what can we do about this? We will baptize the infant. Okay, Anabaptists reject infant baptism. And all of this is tied together then. So what do we think about children then? Well, their answer to that is, yes, there is something in them that makes them want to do bad, but they are not guilty before God for this until they actualize it in life and make a decision, a conscious, knowing decision to rebel against God and do the thing they know He doesn't want. Does all that make sense? All right. That is the Anabaptist view of a child. That is their explanation for why a child is not guilty before God and does not need infant baptism. Anabaptists basically rejected discussions that got too philosophical or into metaphysics. They did not talk about substance. Instead, they like to talk about man's accountability, which then you get into this discussion of free will. Catholics also believe in free will. And most of you probably are aware that, like Luther, the Protestants in general have rejected. Now, this is an overstatement. I got to back up. During the Reformation, most Protestants would have rejected free will and leaned more toward predestination. So, Anabaptist view is that man is accountable for his choices. They emphasized accountability and discipleship and obedience. And they always said that man can do the thing that God calls him to do. In other words, sin is not something that a believer has to do. It's something he chooses to do. Okay, Augustine, in relation to man's ability to do good, he said that the sinner is not able not to sin. This is a play on words. The sinner is not able not to sin. The Christian is able not to sin. And the glorified person is not able to sin. That there's nothing really profound about those. Going to Gregory the Great is the next one I want to talk about a little bit. From 540 to 604, Gregory the Great was one of the popes, and he is credited with, inserting into Catholic doctrine some insidious errors that continued in the Catholic doctrine, Catholic Church, up to the Reformation, and even today. I won't discuss all of his errors, except that during that period of time, his thinking initiated discussion about penance, doing penance, and the penance system. And I'll just read several sentences here that just to help you see what is meant by this. They practice public confession, and if you connect this with church life today, and this will make sense to you. Not everything the Catholics thought was bad. So you make a public confession. Well, how do we know that you're sincere in this confession? Well, you should repent. Now, how do we know you repent? Well, to repent is to change your mind and have a change of heart and change your life. Okay, so part of this confession then would be that you would make restitution. So then there was also private confession, which was brought in, which from my point of view is bad. That is, if it's purely private, when it should be public. But after one had repented of sin and had confessed it, one was assured of absolution by the priest if they made satisfaction. And so this satisfaction could be made by telling someone you were sorry, depending on how bad the thing was you did. You could make a payment of money or whatever. I mean, some sins were not against someone else. So, let's see now. How can you express repentance? Well, give something that costs you. Follow this. Then there was payment of money, or you could do a certain deed like make a pilgrimage or whatever. Now, when money was substituted, this was called redemption, and the person was said to be reconciled after penance was done, and this is part of penance, to do this deed or whatever. And that is, I will come back to that a little later. Okay, the medieval theology, Aquinas, he said that works of love that people do merit a reward from God. In other words, if you do good works, that merits God's reward, which is getting into a works religion. Okay? Now, you see, this is a very touchy thing. What value do works have in God's sight? And he said, works of love merit the value that God places on them. He felt that man could cooperate. He felt that man had something in him that would make him able to do good. And even the sinner could do good. Now, this is a rather difficult thing because, say, for Protestants, for the Reformed, they generally have said, even today, that a sinner can do nothing whatsoever. He can do nothing to get saved. Okay, now an Anabaptist would say that yes, we can respond to God. This is a willing response we make, and we can believe. Reformed would say, no, there is nothing you can do. You can't even believe. God must give you the faith, and then you will be able to believe. So this is a different view. Well, Aquinas, and he lived from 1225 to 1274, by the way, he said that there is something, and he had a high view of man. Anabaptists have a high view of man. He had a high view of man. There's so much stuff here to be said, I have to decide what to go over here. He had a view. I'm trying to decide here. Maybe I should. Decide what to skip here. Okay, Anselm. Let me go to Anselm a little bit. He lived from 1033 to 1109. He had a view of salvation that is called satisfaction. And I want to give you his defense of his view. He had a theory for why Christ became a man and why Christ saves. How Christ's work saves. I'll just read over this. Here's his argument. He said that man dishonored God by pledging his will to the devil. Number two, this is an equation, kind of like a math equation. This honor must be restored. God's honor has been violated by sin. This honor must be restored, so either the sinner must make satisfaction or God must punish the sinner. God cannot forgive unless his honor is satisfied. Step three is, man cannot make satisfaction because man cannot do works beyond what is owed to God. Man owes obedience already, and since this has been violated, man cannot pay this debt of honor that he owes to God. So, sin is an offense to God and takes something greater, his words, than all that exists to atone for it. So man ought to atone for his sin, but he cannot because he has sinned. This debt must be paid by another, by a sinless person, man. And so Christ became a man in order to pay man's debt. Now, to you, that may sound good. In fact, that is the popular Protestant view of how we're saved, of salvation. So you owe a debt. You can't pay the debt. There's nothing you can do good enough to pay this debt. Okay, so Christ paid the debt. Now all you do is trust in Jesus. You will go to heaven. Now on the surface of things, that sounds okay. But the problem with it is, and this is the Anabaptist reaction. They said, yes. And when that's all done, what that means is you have no obligation to God at all. Then you can live like you want and go to heaven. That's the Anabaptist reaction. So Christ paid a debt. All you do is trust Jesus, and then you go on in life. So in that sense, see, in that kind of view, then justification and sanctification have been divorced to such an extent that it doesn't matter how you live. You will go to heaven. Jesus paid my debt. I just trust him. My sins are forgiven. God looks at Jesus' righteousness. He never sees my unrighteousness. I'm saying the seeds to that, that is the popular Protestant view today, and that the seeds of that are back in the medieval period. Now, I suppose you want me to answer all the questions right now. Let's see. Let's go to someone else. Peter Abelard. He lived from 1079 to 1142. He said he believed the view, Anselm's view is called the satisfaction theory. And Abelard's view is called the moral influence theory. He said that Christ's death was simply an example. It's an example. And the way you are helped is simply by following Christ's example. Just follow Christ's example. Now, Anabaptists talked a lot about following Christ's example. We ought to follow the example of Christ. The problem with Abelard, though, is that he gives no reason why you should follow the example of Christ. There is nothing. What has God done? What has Christ done in your heart to make you follow the example of Christ? Well, Abelard does not explain that. He just says, love God and do follow the example of Christ. So, most people would criticize Abelard because he gives no motivation. He gives no reason to love God or to follow him. He just says, the reason for Christ coming to earth and dying is to give us an example of how to suffer and how to live. We should be moved by Christ's example to love God and suffer and do his will. But the motivation, he has no explanation for that. Okay, the next one I have is SCOTUS. The name is spelled S-C-O-T-U-S, last name, John Duns SCOTUS, 1265 to 1308. And the main point on him is just that he said, to the question of why does God save people, how does God save people? He says, God could have saved people any kind of way he wanted to. He just decided, I'll just save them. The work of Christ is not worthy of salvation for people. God just decided, okay, Christ dies, I'll just save people because Christ died. It's all a will. Which means then that God's working with men is not based on his character. It's not based on his character, it's just on his will. Now see, this then becomes connected with Protestant view of salvation today too. So you live like the devil? Did you trust Jesus? Well, if you did, God has already decided that if you trust Jesus, he paid your debt, you will go to heaven. How do you live? Well, God's evaluation there, see, of you going to heaven is not really related to your character, the way you live. So what I'm saying is, this idea from the Middle Ages also got incorporated into a Protestant view, and obviously the Anabaptists did not like this. They said, and this is where you get works, this is where you get this faith works question. So how do works relate to faith? How does sanctification relate to justification? Can you live like you want? And God evaluates you and says, well, you're fine. My will says you're fine. You trusted Jesus when his character, you're not living up to his character, you're not even caring. Occam, the next one I have, 1300 to 1349. Occam, William of Occam. He said that God's decision is unrelated in any way to his character. His decision about people, his evaluation of people, God's obligation to act in a certain way or to reward certain forms of behavior, it has nothing to do with his character. It's just a decision he makes in his mind. God could forgive people for whatever reason he chose. He even made a statement that God could have used an animal for a sacrifice. Okay, a summary then, and then we'll go to the Anabaptists. A summary of the Roman Catholic position, and I did not talk about this up to this point, but the first thing I would say is the Roman Catholicism usually, traditionally, has looked at salvation as at conversion as a substance change. Substance change. A change in your essence. It's almost a physical thing. Now you ask, how does this happen for a Catholic? This happens because you eat the bread and drink the wine. Because the bread and the wine are changed into the body and blood of Christ. And so when you eat this, you are eating the divine nature. This enters into your body, and you are, I'm not giving you any explanation. I do not understand this. I have never heard a good explanation. Nobody understands this. This enters into your body, and you become divine. Your substance is changed. On what basis does God consider a good Catholic in their mind as being right with Him? On the basis that they have partaken of the sacrament. Salvation rests in the sacraments, in partaking of the sacraments. It does not rest in the way you live for a Catholic. Now, and this, I'll admit you, there are a lot of things about what I'm telling you that I don't fully understand all these views. The puzzling thing to me in this is, although you were saved by this sacrament, partaking of communion, they worked so hard. Well, let's see. They did not work so hard at getting you to live right, but they worked very hard at trying to help you feel good about your sins. And so you have confession. You have penance. Which, although you can't do better, you can feel better. Okay? So, salvation, they did work hard. Catholics worked hard at good works. But it was more in getting forgiveness for you for them, for bad works, than it was in helping you do good works. So it wasn't as if they thought that this substance change was going to change your heart or your motivation. And make you live better. It was that God was just going to say, because you partook of Christ in the sacraments, you're saved. Your substance is changed, whatever that means. And because you partake of the sacraments in relation to your ongoing sins, that takes care of the guilt for these things, and you will go to heaven. Now, of course, there are all kinds of things involved in this, like if you aren't quite sure about this and you end up you die, then people can pray and pay and do whatever else to get you out of purgatory because of bad works you've done. There's all kinds of things in this. But this is the basic view of conversion. They did keep justification and sanctification closely together through the sacramental system, not through a practical outworking in the life. And so righteousness, inner righteousness then, for the Catholics, their theology is that inner righteousness is rooted in the sacraments and not in righteous behavior. Now obviously this is very unacceptable to Anabaptists. They don't like this at all. They don't want righteousness to be rooted in things you can do religiously. Righteousness for the Christian is connected to and rooted for an Anabaptist is rooted in trusting God, trusting Christ, having a change of heart, willing to do good, finding the strength, grace, victory in Christ, dying with Christ, rising with Him, willing to do His will, obedience. The faith that works obedience, that is an Anabaptist view of this, not some dependence in the sacramental manipulation to make people have a substance change. Again, Anabaptists do not talk about substance. They talk about action, will to do God's will, and doing God's will or acting God's will. And then we are doing the righteous thing, the right thing, and God He accepts us. Maybe my statements aren't entirely clear, but we will come around again later. I want to go to Luther then, reactions to the Roman Catholic Church. I want to talk a little bit about Luther, two or three men, non-Protestant, and then Anabaptist. First of all, Luther. Luther is very confusing in that he is kind of in between the old and the new. That is, he has a lot of the old Catholic view, but he has some things about him that the Protestants, his followers, take and turn into what we have today. One thing for you to understand is that neither Luther or Calvin believed everything that their followers believed or claimed that they believed. Okay, let's be fair with them. It's just like you or I, it's like this in life. The people that repeat what you said, they hardly ever represented exactly the way you said it or the way you believed it. That is even true in this. Luther, I have, four main comments on Luther, just summary comments about him. He believed, first of all, the terms I'm using are intentional. He believed on a for you and an in you Christ. In other words, Christ died for you on the cross back in history. And that is a work outside of you. But he also is in you. It's not just outside. He is also in you. So justification for Luther includes both trust in the work of Christ outside and union with him that he is living in you. He had a strong view of Christ's presence in the believer. In fact, so strong a view of that, and this is kind of off on the side track, but he had such a strong view of that, that's partly why he had the view of the Lord's Supper that he did, that Christ is in you. In other words, he even said, as the Catholics, that you partake of Christ. You partake of Christ when you partake of the Lord's Supper. But he did not say that the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ. That is the distinction between Luther and the Catholics. Okay, the first thing, Christ is for you and he is in you. The second thing, he reacted to the Catholics' view of works, their emphasis on works, and he belittled works. He emphasized faith and belittled works. This is a reaction. And by the way, beware, all of you, all of us, Christ. Okay, that was four. I don't have this in my notes this way. Let me give you five. He also emphasized imputation. He talked about imputation. Now, with only half the truth and on the negative side of it. So that you can see this in others, but it's hard to see it in ourselves. So I'm just saying we need to beware. He rejected works. Okay, the third one, he rejects historical faith as an adequate means for salvation. He rejects historical faith. Now, let me explain that. This idea that Christ died on the cross, if you just believe that intellectually, that will save you. He rejects that. He accepts of Christ's alien righteousness to you. Probably, this is just my judgment of it, probably he emphasized this imputation. In other words, let me explain. You want to be righteous before God, but you sin once in a while. How can you be righteous before God in God's eyes if you sin? Well, the answer, a traditional Protestant answer is, God has taken the righteousness from Christ that he has, and this is even Catholic. The excess righteousness that Christ has is credited to your account. It is imputed to you. Does that make any sense? The righteousness of Christ is imputed to your account or credited to your account. This is not a righteousness that's in you or that you have done by your works. This is something in Christ that is just put to your account. Okay, Luther emphasized that, not like his followers, but he talked about imputation. And so his followers took that, and through process of a century, this got developed into what we have today. My feeling is, one reason that Luther emphasized this imputation of alien righteousness was because, and this is a valid concern, because he did not want to make justification and being righteous in God's eyes depend purely on how you live. Okay? If you make being righteous in God's eyes depend purely on how you live, you will never have this thing up high enough to feel good about getting to heaven. Okay? So there is a dilemma in this for Anabaptists too. It's a dilemma for us. I hope you see the dilemma. See, there's a problem. You don't want to get justification and sanctification so that people are lost every time they sin, but you don't want to have it so that they can sin, live in sin, and then this righteousness is imputed to them, and then they just go to heaven. It doesn't make any difference. God's character, his evaluation of the believer that's living in sin has nothing to do with the believer's character. See, okay, so there's the little dilemma in this. And this is, I think, Luther's way of getting around this problem. All right, the next one I have is Melanchthon. The rest of those you probably could spell. Melanchthon. Philip Melanchthon, he is the Luther's right-hand man. His view, it is generally accepted. This is a common understanding of Melanchthon. Historical. This is not my evaluation. This is the common evaluation, is that Melanchthon is the one who introduced the modern Protestant imputation. What I've been describing is a Protestant view and have referred to in a negative way. Everybody. All historians, theologians agree that this is Melanchthon's interpretation of Luther, that this is credited to Melanchthon. I don't have time to go into this, but there are various reasons why he came to this conclusion. The end result was, in his view, Christ's righteousness is imputed to the believer, to the sinner. The sinner is not changed in his nature. He's not changed in his heart. Regeneration, for Melanchthon, regeneration and justification are completely separated. Regeneration has nothing to do. Justification has nothing to do with regeneration of the heart. And this is really, I don't understand how you can do that, but it's just saying that if you said, I do trust in Jesus, then this imputation process takes place, and you could still have an evil heart and still want to do bad, but you're a Christian. There's been no change in your heart in any way, no motivational change. So, Melanchthon has split regeneration and justification. Now, I did not... Anabaptists keep regeneration and justification together. I think Luther tried very hard to keep regeneration and justification together. That is that for an Anabaptist to become a believer is to have your heart changed, your motivations changed, your desires changed. That is not so much an issue as it is what to do about how justification and sanctification relate for us. In other words, I think most of us agree there's got to be a heart change. The Bible teaches a change of heart, a new birth. The bigger problem, I think, is in salvation, change in our lives. How do sanctification and justification relate? I think I will skip Osiander and Calvin. Let's go to the Anabaptists then. I've talked about original sin in relation to Augustine. And again, Anabaptists did not deny that people have something that's traditionally called original sin. They said that the child is not guilty before God because of it. That is the root of a child's decision to disobey. But a child is not guilty for the original sin. He's guilty for his act of sin that's produced by this. So by and large, they ignore discussions about original sin, what it is, all of that. And they talk about instead the fruit of it in the act. So what is sin? It is an act or an attitude that violates or goes against God's will. It's a choice to do something that is displeasing to God. I'm just making this simple in my own words here. The first issue under Anabaptists, I have six or seven of them. The first one is original sin. The second one is the will of man. The will of man. For an Anabaptist, man has a free choice. They recognize that there are always... The devil is at work all the time, and so the choice is not, in a sense, not completely free. That is, our choices are not free, completely free of outside influences. They are free in the sense that we are never aware or conscious, we never have the sense that we are being forced by God or the devil to do what we're doing. We choose this. As far as we can determine ourselves or evaluate our action, it's out of our own consideration. Luther said that man's will is fallen. It's fallen before he's saved. It's fallen after he's saved. He has a bound will. He said the redeemed person still has an evil nature. I expect Merle's going to grab that one. The sinner still has an evil nature. He still has an evil heart. That is probably one of the worst things about Luther. He never gets a sinner. He never says a sinner has a regenerated heart in the proper sense that his heart is really new and different. He still has this evil nature, this evil heart, he has evil desires, and he has a bound will. Now, he gets around, there's a problem in that because on the surface it sounds like, okay, if you have a bound will as a Christian, you can never make a good decision. Well, his answer to that is, it's kind of ambiguous, but his answer to that is, well, if you are a sinner, you're bound by the devil. And your decisions must be bad. But if you are a Christian, then there is some possibility of doing good. But he still has this evil nature here, and I'm confusing it, aren't I? Go to school a while and listen to the teachers, and you'll be confused too. The confusing thing about Luther is he believed in infant baptism, and he believed in justification by faith. Those two do not go together. And even in class, No one ever could figure out, read all the material, we could not figure out what his view was, even on justification, whether it happens at infant baptism or at some point along the way by justification by faith. The way he gets around this is to say that infants can have faith. And then he goes to great length to explain how infants can have faith. Okay? The work of Christ. Is that number three? No. I skipped one. Their view of baptism. I must skip that. The third was baptism. The fourth is the work of Christ. The pamphlet or the tract, the satisfaction of Christ. The satisfaction of Christ is the one of the best known, a very short writing by Michael Sattler, it's assumed, on the work of Christ. The question in this pamphlet is, what is it that Christ did that saves? That's the question that's asked, but the answer to the question is never given in the tract. Because Anabaptists never did try to figure out a scientific explanation for why Christ's work saves people. The Anabaptists saw salvation as galosenheit. Galosenheit. Some of you here are German, are you? Galosenheit? What is this? What does this mean?
Galosen means left, doesn't it?
Means what?
Abandoned?
Yeah, the word is abandoned. For an Anabaptist, the way you get saved is to abandon yourself to God, to give up all that you depend on, all your props, money. In fact, the Hutterites turn this into this idea then that if you even depend, if you have financial, you have goods, that they are a hindrance to salvation. Now, as much as you may not like the Hutterite view of community of goods, they do have a point. You can look in America today and see one reason people don't trust Christ today is because they trust something else. This is the point here, galosenheit. This part of it is submission to God, abandoning your own basis of security and whatever else, and you just cast yourself on the Lord to deliver you. True discipleship is a result of giving up everything, all personal desires and dependence on anything other than Christ. You abandon the soul, the whole person to God. And then righteousness is worked in the heart. And it's worked in the heart only when there is complete abandonment to do the will of God. Righteousness, this pamphlet, the satisfaction of Christ, the question is, what is it that satisfies God? The answer that's given is that the work of Christ satisfied God, but the statement is also made that what really satisfies God is the work that God does in the heart that produces the fruit. And so in the end, the article says that it's the fruit that satisfies God. Okay? You follow what I'm saying? What satisfies God? They don't say, oh, it's trust in Jesus. Christ did a work on the cross. And they don't give Anselm's explanation. They don't have any scientific explanation. They say God does a work in the heart as you trust Jesus. This work produces a work in your life that satisfies God or is pleasing to God. So, what is it about Christ's work that satisfies God? Answer, good works in your life. Okay, the reaction to that is, works religion. See, that's how that happens. The work of Christ. So my point on the work of Christ is they give no grand explanation about the work of Christ, how it saves or what, in as far as the cross work. What they talk about is how it should be applied. So Christ died, well, salvation, and they go to Romans 6, is then that you die with Christ. You abandon yourself to Christ. All your desires are abandoned. You die to them, just like Christ died, well, in Hebrews 10. Important to them because it says that Christ did the will of the Father because he willed to do the will of the Father, and he went to the cross because he willed the will of the Father, even though he may not have wanted to. Okay, so then their question is, why was Christ obedient to the Father? The answer, they didn't say because he was divine, like many of us do. They said because he was obedient to the Father because, as a human on the earth, he willed to do the will of the Father. It didn't feel good. He didn't want to. I mean, it hurt. He did it. So salvation then, for an Anabaptist, is not just the work of Christ. It's our identification with him, in dying with him. Then he rose from the grave, and they emphasized the resurrection of Christ then, and that we identify, Romans 6 again, we identify with Christ's resurrection, and he works in our heart, changes our heart, gives us a new motivation, new desires, and then we can live a holy life. Okay, the fifth point I have, the fifth doctrinal issue, is on redemption, justification, and grace. Anabaptists did not use the term, and I'm not even sure if I can pronounce this correctly, the German term, Rechtfertigung. Someone help me. I know you can. Justification. They did not use the word, the German word is gerecht. Klaring, I can't pronounce his word correctly, but to the correct is clearing is to declare righteous. They didn't use the word. They didn't talk about God declaring you righteous. They didn't talk about God justifying you. They didn't use. You can't even find the word justification in the Mennonite Encyclopedia. They used the term gerecht machen, meaning to make righteous, that God makes you righteous. They meant by that God changes your heart, that makes you righteous, and then he changes your life, and that makes you righteous too. Okay? And then they would have said, if God has not both made you righteous in your heart and made you righteous in your life, then you are not righteous in his sight. And he's not going to say that you're righteous just to say that you're righteous. Just because you said you trusted Jesus, he won't say you're righteous. And so, in that sense, they connect justification and sanctification. Now, this, I'm going to articulate an Anabaptist view of justification that is not the way they would have said it, okay? I think what I'm going to say is what they believed, but I admit to you, you will not find this statement anywhere, because the statement I'm going to make is made this way because of the modern discussion. Today, if you do not include in a statement of justification something about God declaring that you're righteous, you are a heretic. So I'm going to include that. Okay? Justification is God's evaluation and declaration that a person is righteous in his sight. Justification is God's evaluation and declaration that a person is righteous in his sight. The question is not that. The question is, on what basis is God evaluating that you're righteous? Okay, for an Anabaptist, it's that you have been made righteous in your heart. That is, there has been a change of heart. Not a substance change, but a change in the... there's been a new birth. I'm really struggling. I want to stay out of these metaphysical and philosophical terms tonight. I mean, if the Bible calls it a new birth, then I hope you understand what I mean. That has happened to the heart. The person has been forgiven. So there's a removal of guilt. Christ enters into the believer. Now, you could have a big discussion about whether this is physical, metaphysical, how this happens, how spiritual, how is this? I'm not going to try to explain that. All I'm saying is they believe strongly that you are brought into union with Christ. You don't just get Christ's righteousness. You don't just get some imputation of his righteousness to your account in heaven. You get Christ. You get all of him. You get his life. You get his victory. You get his character. That is then, must then, sanctification be worked out in your life. Okay? Anabaptists did not say that it is easy for this to be worked out in life. They said that this working out in life is a result of great pain and suffering. Which is a little different than some people talk today. They said this is a result of pain and suffering. Now this is, one, in my view, one of the reasons that people today have trouble, believers have trouble living the Christian life, is they do not want it to include any pain and suffering. It's going to be easy. It's going to be automatic. It's going to happen. Even Mennonites. I'm saved. I'm born again. This ought to just come on out. Well, it doesn't just come on out. Well, why not? Well, because we have this way we lived and thought and all of this stuff before we were saved. And you get this thing with children. Why don't they just do better? Well, they don't just want to do better. They have this way of doing that they've had all their life. It gets them what they want, and they have ways of manipulating their parents and their brothers and sisters and all these sinful habits, patterns. So then the sixth item then with Anabaptists is discipleship. Now the trouble with discipleship is that if you emphasize discipleship and obedience by itself, and if it's emphasized only as keeping rules, even at school, you undermine what you're trying to accomplish, because people, first of all, need to have something happen in their heart that moves them this way. And there are reasons why people are not motivated to do what is right. Some of the time, I'm just ad-libbing here a little, sometimes they're angry at God because he's hurt them. Sometimes they're angry at people. They may just be rebellious or whatever. I'm not going to explain all of that, but my point is just that discipleship and obedience is the result of faith and a new heart. And when we just work on the discipleship and obedience, we might make people conform, but until they see what they're doing wrong as a product of a sinful desire and something they must suffer and die to, this will all be an external manipulation on our part. The last one I have here is faith and works, and I guess I've been on that the whole time this morning. Anabaptists are accused the Lutherans, even Catholics, of believing in a works religion. And they always denied this. They always said that was not true. They said we are saved unto good works. We don't expect to get to heaven by good works. You can read in Menno Simons, he says clearly, I do not believe you get to heaven by good works, but I don't believe you get there without them. The sole basis of getting to heaven is not good works, and we do not base salvation on good works. So I'm saying this thing of faith and works is a difficult thing. It's very hard to get all of this worked out and say it exactly right. May the Lord give us direction in these things. Let's take a 10-minute break, shall we? Out of here, whatever. Thank you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.